Of the dead, speak nothing but good.
Mr. Zong, yes. The piece that you've just seen, titled Under Alabaster, is the product of a series of workshops conducted earlier this week under the guidance of A.D. White Professor at Large Ann Carson and her collaborator Robert Curry. The participants in the workshop and performers in Under Alabaster are Liz Blake, Alex Chertok, Will Cordero, Carolyn Gelzer, Christian Howard, Sally Wen Mao, Emma Catherine Perry, Emily Riles, Avery Slater, and Ruo Ji Tang. My name is Kevin Attell. I teach in the English department, and it's my great pleasure to introduce once again Ann Carson, who last night delivered a marvelous lecture on Homer, Moravia, and Godard before a screening of Godard's Contempt at the cinema. The recipient of many awards and honors, including Guggenheim and MacArthur Fellowships, as well as the Order of Canada, Ann Carson is one of the most important and influential contemporary poets working in the English language. She taught classics for many years at the University of Michigan and has also taught or been a visiting scholar, poet, or fellow at a number of other institutions, including the American Academy in Berlin, the Getty Center, Princeton University, McGill University, and UC Berkeley. She is currently a distinguished poet in residence at New York University. Professor Carson's most recent book is Knox, 2010, a stunning meditation on loss, distance, memory, and Catullus's poem number 101. Carson's previous volumes of poetry and essays include Glass, Irony, and God, 1992, Plain Water, 1995, Autobiography of Red, a novel in verse, 1998, The Beauty of the Husband, 2001, and Decreation, 2005. And as I mentioned last night, and will mention again, this book, Decreation, includes several pieces centering on the work of another A.D. White professor, Italian film director Michelangelo Antonioni, whose film Red Desert is, by happy coincidence, playing at the Cornell Cinema this weekend. Professor Carson is furthermore an esteemed scholar and translator of Greek literature. Her scholarly work includes her first book, Eros the Bittersweet, from 1986, as well as Economy of the Unlost, from 1999. And her translations, all from the last decade or so, include Sophocles' Electra, If Not Winter, Fragments of Sappho, Grief Lessons, Four Plays by Euripides, and a forthcoming illustrated version of Sophocles' Antigone, created in collaboration with Robert Curry and artist Bianca Stone, which is being published by New Directions later this year. And the New Directions website has some sample pages to see, and it does look beautiful. Ann Carson and Robert Curry have also collaborated on a number of theatrical, multimedial, and dance productions, such as the ones we will see tonight, and have performed at venues around the world. In addition to working with companies staging theatrical productions of her translations of Greek drama, Carson and Curry have collaborated on projects with, among others, Big Dance Theater, Merce Cunningham Dance Company, and as it happens, yet another A.D. White professor, dancer and choreographer William Forsythe, who is, by another happy coincidence, visiting campus in a few weeks. In 2003, Forsythe created a piece based on Carson's essay, Decreation, and it was most recently performed at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in 2009. Tonight, Carson and Curry will be performing two pieces, first Bracco, and then Cassandra Float Can. And joining them will be Jacob Brogan, Gina Elia, Mandy Gutman-Gonzalez, Gustavo Larule, Shiloh McGiff, Emma Catherine Perry, Dan Sinekin, Avery Slater, and Christine Yao. And lastly, after the performance, there will not be a question and answer period, but there is a reception where you will be able to meet and converse with all the participants in tonight's performance. Please join me in welcoming Ann Carson and Robert Curry.
Hi, good evening. I'm Ann Carson, without Robert Curry. We're going to present this evening, with the help of some other people, two pieces, as Kevin said, Bracco first and Cassandra Floatcan second. Bracco is intended as an evocation of the text of Sappho. The word Bracco is an invention made out of Sappho plus bracket. Sappho, as you know, was a musician who lived on the island of Lesbos from about 653 BC until her death, no one knows when. She devoted her life to composing songs to be sung to the lyre. Alexandrian scholars collected her songs in 9 books, all of which are lost. Sappho was also a poet. Whether or not she herself was literate is unknown, but the words to her songs were written down during or soon after her lifetime and existed on papyrus by the end of the 5th century BC. On a papyrus roll, the text is written in columns without word division, punctuation, or lineation. To read such a text is hard, even when it comes to us in its entirety, and most papyri don't. Of the 9 books of lyrics that Sappho is said to have composed, only one poem has survived complete. All the rest are fragments. She is not the only poet whose extant work is fragmentary, but she does seem to exist as a pleasure for us, as much because of what is lacking as because of what is present. Every history of Sappho contains so much that it does not contain. When I translated Sappho's fragments in a book a few years ago, I attempted to suggest these various kinds of absent presence by using brackets and empty space on the pages. There's a stanza of Emily Dickinson's that summarizes the sensation I was trying to evoke. It's from a poem that begins, "To disappear enhances," and it ends with this stanza, "The fruit perverse to plucking, but leaning to the sight, with the ecstatic limit of unobtained delight." Bracco is a choral work. It'll be performed by myself, Robert Curry, Jacob Brogan, and Dan Sinikin. The score was created by Curry and myself using various chance operations, including a star map of the night sky on the island of Lesbos on the night Sappho was born, and various other mechanisms which I can describe to you later at the reception if you're interested. So, let's go.
Fragment 5.
O Cupris and Nereids, undamaged, I pray you, grant my brother to arrive here, and all that in his heart he wants to be, make it be.
And all the wrong
he did before,
loose it. Make him a joy to his
friends,
a pain to his enemies,
and let there
exist for us not one single further sorrow. May he willingly give his
sister
her portion of honor, but sad
pain,
bracket,
grieving
for the past,
bracket, bracket,
millet seed,
bracket,
of citizens,
bracket,
once again know,
bracket, bracket, bracket,
but you, Cupris,
bracket,
setting aside evil,
bracket, bracket. Fragment 7, bracket,
Doricus,
bracket,
gives orders for not,
bracket, bracket,
top pride,
bracket,
like young men,
bracket,
beloved,
bracket. Fragment 9, bracket,
invites,
bracket,
all not,
bracket,
feast,
bracket,
for Hera,
bracket, bracket,
as long as,
bracket, bracket, bracket. Fragment 12, bracket, 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 bracket.
Thought,
bracket,
barefoot,
bracket, 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 bracket. Fragment 15A and 15B, bracket.
Blessed.
Bracket, bracket, bracket.
To loose all the
wrongs he did before.
Bracket, bracket.
By luck of the harbor.
Bracket.
Cupris, and may she find you very bitter and not go boasting. The Dorica, how he came a second time.
Bracket.
To love's desire.
Fragment 18.
Pan, to tell.
Bracket.
Tongue.
Bracket.
To tell tales.
Bracket.
And for a man, greater.
Bracket. Fragment 19. Bracket, bracket.
Waiting.
Bracket.
In sacrifices.
Bracket.
Having good.
Bracket, bracket.
But going.
Bracket.
For we know.
Bracket.
Of works.
Bracket, bracket.
After.
Bracket.
7.1.
Bracket.
Ancient sources suggest that Dorica is the name of a courtesan favored by Sappho's brother, Caraxes.
Fragment 20, bracket, bracket.
Gladness.
Bracket, bracket.
With good luck.
Bracket.
To gain the harbor.
Bracket.
Of black earth.
Bracket, bracket.
Sailors.
Bracket.
In big blasts of wind.
Bracket.
Upon dry land.
Bracket, bracket.
Sail.
Bracket.
The freight.
Bracket.
When.
Bracket, bracket.
Many.
Bracket, 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 bracket.
Works.
Bracket.
Dry land.
Bracket, bracket, bracket. Fragment 30.
Night.
Bracket.
Girls all night long might sing
of the love
between you and the bride
with violets in her
lap.
Wake and go call the young men so that no more than the bird with piercing voice shall we sleep.
Fragment 31.
He seems to me equal to gods, that man, whoever he is, who opposite you sits and listens close to your sweet speaking and lovely laughing.
53.
Oh, it puts the heart in my chest
this
on wings.
Is cited by Athenaeus.
For when I look
in
at you, even a moment,
chickpeas.
No speaking is left in me. No, tongue breaks, and thin fire is racing under skin, and in eyes no sight.
And drumming.
Fills ears, and cold sweat holds me.
And shaking.
Grips me all greener than
grass.
I am and dead, or almost, I seem to me. But all is to be dared because
even a person of poverty.
Fragment 41.
For you, beautiful ones, my thought is not changeable.
Fragment 43. Bracket, 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 bracket.
Beautiful he.
Bracket.
Stirs up still things.
Bracket.
Exhaustion, the mind.
Bracket.
Settles down.
Bracket.
But come, O beloveds.
Bracket.
For day is near.
Fragment 50.
For the man who is beautiful is beautiful
to see.
But the good man will at
once also beautiful be.
Fragment 53.
Pure graces with arms like roses, come here, daughters of Zeus.
Fragment 54.
Having come from heaven wrapped in a purple
cloak.
Fragment 55.
Dead you will lie, and never memory of you will there be, nor desire into the aftertime. For you do not share in the roses of Pyrrhea, but invisible to Hades' house. You will go your own way among dim shapes, having been breathed out.
Fragment 56.
Not one girl, I think, who looks on the light of the sun will ever have wisdom like this.
Ninety-four point one. The poem's first word is a perfect active infinitive, to be dead or to have died, denoting a past action, death,
fragment
that slides
60,
into the present
bracket,
as death wish,
having encountered,
sliding
bracket,
from
wants,
past to
bracket,
present,
accomplish the plan.
Past,
bracket.
I call out
method
bracket,
in this poem,
to the heart at once.
And she seems
bracket,
to offer
all that you
the sliding
wish to win,
screens
bracket,
of memory
to fight for me,
as a bracket, consolation
by the wanton
to the
one
woman
persuaded
who weeps,
bracket,
as she
but yes,
goes away.
You know well
bracket,
because the beginning
bracket,
of the poem is lost.
Fragment 62.
It remains unclear
you coward,
whether it is
bracket,
Sappho
laurel tree,
or the weeping
bracket,
woman who
but
is everything sweeter
death,
bracket,
than
that
bracket,
and for them
bracket,
traveler
bracket.
But I scarcely ever listened,
bracket,
so beloved,
bracket,
and such now,
bracket,
to arrive kindly,
bracket.
You got there first, beautiful,
bracket,
and the clothes,
bracket. Fragment 63.
Dream of black,
bracket.
You come roaming,
roaming, and when sleep,
bracket.
Sweet
God, terribly from pain,
to
bracket,
hold the strength separate,
bracket,
but I expect not to share,
bracket,
nothing of the blessed ones,
bracket,
for I would not be like this,
bracket,
toys,
bracket,
but may it happen to me,
bracket,
all,
bracket. Fragment 67A, bracket,
and this,
bracket,
ruinous God,
bracket,
I swear did not love,
bracket,
but now because,
bracket,
and the reason neither,
bracket,
nothing much,
bracket, bracket. Fragment 69, bracket, bracket,
sinful,
bracket. Fragment 71, bracket,
you, Mika,
bracket,
but I will not allow you,
bracket,
you chose the love of pentalids,
bracket,
evil turning,
bracket,
some sweet song,
bracket,
in honey voice,
bracket,
piercing breezes,
bracket,
wet with dew.
Fragment 81, bracket,
despise,
bracket,
quick
as
possible,
bracket,
but you, Odika,
bind
your
hair with
lovely
crowns,
tying stems of anise together in your soft hands.
146.
For the blessed graces
and honey
prefer
associated
to look on one who wears
in
flowers
cult
and turn away
symbology
from those without
the
a crown.
May also imply
fragment
a renunciation
85A
of things
and fragment 85B.
Other translations
bracket,
occur to me,
bracket,
e.g.
bracket,
mellow
prosperous
honey,
bracket,
yellow steam
like an old man,
honey,
bracket,
to
honey,
listen,
bracket,
no,
bracket,
not me.
Fragment 87A, bracket. Bracket, bracket, bracket.
Rumor.
Bracket.
Hair.
Bracket.
At the same time.
Bracket.
Man.
Bracket, bracket. Fragment 87B, bracket.
Anxiety grounds.
Bracket.
156.
Fragment 87C.
On style, quotes
bracket,
these phrases
bracket,
in a discussion of hyperbole.
Daring.
Fragment
pointing
94.
Out that every hyperbole involves
the impossible. I simply want
to
be dead.
And comparing
weeping,
phrases
she
from
left
Aristophanes
me with many
like
tears
healthier
and said
than a
this
pumpkin and
oh,
bolder
how badly
than a clear
things
sky
have turned out for us.
He congratulates
Sappho, I
swear, for using
against
the impossible
my will
gracefully,
I leave you.
Not
and I
frigidly
answered
her,
rejoice, go and remember me.
For you know how we cherished you. But if not, I want to remind you.
Bracket.
In beautiful times we had.
For many crowns of violets and roses.
Bracket.
At my side you put on, and many woven garlands made of flowers around your soft throat.
Fragment 98B.
But for you, Cleus, I have no spangled, where would I get it, headbinder. Yet the Mytilenean.
Bracket, 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 bracket.
To hold.
Bracket.
Spangled. These things of the Cleanactidae, exile, memories, terribly
leaked away.
Fragment 104A.
Evening, you gather back all that dazzling dawn has put asunder. You gather a lamb, gather a kid, gather a child to its mother.
3.11. All night long. If this reading is correct, Sappho may be pursuing her own night thoughts. One editor thinks these thoughts concern her brother, or else
fragment 120
in a nocturnal
but
ritual.
But I am not someone who likes to wound.
Such rituals
rather, I have a
were
quiet
a feature
mind
of ancient
fragment
Greek
132
worship, and turn
I have a beautiful
in
child who is like golden flowers
who describes
in form,
a chorus
darling Cleis,
Athena,
in exchange
like
for
this,
whom I would not
on
all
the windy
Lydia more lovely
ridge,
fragment 150
voices of girls.
For it is not right in a house of the muses that there be lament. This would not become us.
Dancing.
Fragment 151.
And on the eyes, black sleep of night.
Fragment 181.
Crossable.
Fragment 182.
I might go.
Fragment 183.
Down rushing.
Fragment 192.
Gold ankle bone
cups.
The end. Hi, me again. Cassandra Floatcan, like Bracco in a way, is an essay in translation, that is, an essay in the real sense, an attempt at translation, a foray. And it touches on topics like Cassandra herself, the famous princess of Troy, daughter of Priam, a prophet destined to always prophesy the truth and never be believed. Also talks a bit about Aeschylus and the Agamemnon and some other more modern artists. It's organized for reasons that will become gradually clear in three sections that are called cuts. So there's the original cut, the birthday cut, and the final cut. Cassandra Floatcan, original cut. Everywhere Cassandra ran, Cassandra found she could float. How did she float? With her float can. Does that sound like a tautology? But the arts of prophecy are often tautological. They reason in a circle. The prophet must prove to you that she is a prophet by telling you unbelievable news, which you will only believe if you already regard her as a prophet. If the news is not unbelievable, then she is just a news source. If the news subsequently comes true, then she was a prophet, but it doesn't matter now that the news is widely available. Cassandra's is a conundrum of the veil. Where is the edge of the new? Where is the edge of belief? Is it possible to believe something truly unbelievable? How does that begin? Is there a crack of light under the door? How do you know to see it as light? Is there an edge of light all around the dark mass of your life up to this moment? Can you see the dark mass as a veil? Can you want it gone? Can you say, flick-flack, it's gone? Cassandra can. Who is Cassandra? For a dime, she will tell you that the swimming pool is full of blood. Like space-time, she is non-linear, non-narrative, and the most beautiful of Priam's daughters, according to Homer, who says that when she stood up to prophesy, she shone like a lamp in a bomb shelter. Your eye is inclined to bounce off, then glue itself onto Cassandra's surface. The longer you look at her, the more fiercely you have to struggle to see her light, which seems to sink its beam into you at a hotter and hotter frequency. Eventually, you notice that something stinks. It is the gelatin of your own eyeball. A smell at once small and gigantic. Some people find it sexual, I do not. To me, it is the smell of matter experiencing its own future. Scientifically, the smell of a rip in space-time. Sometimes I feel I spend my whole life rewriting the same page. It is a page with essay on translation at the top, and then quite a few paragraphs of good, strong prose. These begin to break down towards the middle of the page. Syntax decays, perforations appear. By the end, there's not much left but a few flakes of language roaming near the margins, looking as if they want to become an art of pure shape. Here is another fact about me. Whenever I am engaged on a translation project, I experience continually, offside my vision, a sensation of veils flying up. As brightness blows the rising, wide, cold rush the skull. I've come to call the sensation Cassandra because I first noticed it one day in school when I was trying to translate a passage of Aeschylus' Agamemnon, the passage where Cassandra cries out in Greek, Atatatoi papoida. This cry is famous. It leads into 300 lines of vision and prophecy in which Cassandra tells the past and future of the house of Atreus, including the fact of her own death. At the midpoint of this telling, she utters these lines. Behold, no longer my oracle out from veils shall be glancing like a newly married bride, but as brightness blows the rising sun open, it will rush my oceans forward onto light, a grief more deep than me. What is it like to be a prophet? Everywhere Cassandra ran, she found she was already there. Everywhere Cassandra ran, the glue was coming up off the edge of the page, and when she pulled at it, this page was underneath this page on which I am telling you that everywhere Cassandra ran, she found she could float. You may think I am making the matter unnecessarily complicated, the matter of Cassandra everywhere she ran, but let's return to her opening line. Atatatoi papoida. This utterance is a scream. It is untranslatable and yet not meaningless. A scream conveys specific emotion and can make things happen. In this case, the scream is also metrically exact, fitted into the scansion of the verses around it. Often in English translation, such utterances are rendered by the word alas. Should alas seem inadequate, the translator may choose to transliterate the Greek letters of the scream into English sounds, as I did when I said, atatatoi papoida, on the grounds that this is more pure and true. Is it more pure and true? Perhaps a prior question is in order. What is Cassandra doing speaking Greek? She is, after all, a Trojan princess who has never been away from home before. Now, generally, we refrain from asking this kind of question about the logic of a play. We don't really want to listen to Cassandra speaking ancient Trojan for the next half hour, and there is a dramaturgic convention called the willed suspension of disbelief that makes it okay. But in this play, Aeschylus has already punctured the convention, for he begins the Cassandra scene with Cassandra standing silent on stage for 270 lines. Then Clytemnestra shouts at her, "What's the matter? Don't you speak Greek?" Aeschylus would like us to see the veils flying up in Cassandra's mind, would like us to be wondering at what level of herself she is translating some pure gash of Trojan emotion into a metrically perfect line of Greek tragic verse, and what that translation has to do with the arts of prophecy. Because in both cases there is some action of cutting through surfaces to a sight that has no business being underneath. What is the future doing underneath the past? Or Greek metrics inside a Trojan silence? And how does it alter it to see it there floating, and how can it float? I am interested in people who cut through things. When Aeschylus' Agamemnon was performed at Cambridge University, England, as the Cambridge Greek play for 1900, the role of Cassandra was taken by a young man named J.F. Crace. Mr. Crace wore veils and made a wonderful impression. He was probably encouraged, as were other young actors who played Cassandra in those days, to let his voice crack on stage during Cassandra's long speech. This was thought to add poignancy to the delivery and show the prophet stimulated to a breaking point. Cracks, cuts, breaks, gashes, splittings, slicings, rips, tears, conical intersects, disruptions, etymologies. Here is another one I like. It has nothing to do with Cassandra. We need a break from Cassandra. I have a friend who is a philosopher. He told me that the phenomenologist, Edmund Husserl, who lived 1859 to 1958 and wrote a dozen or so books in his lifetime, left behind at his death some 30,000 pages of unpublished manuscript. Moreover, these pages are written in shorthand. The notion of 30,000 pages of Bavarian shorthand fills me with wonder. Why did Husserl want to write so fast? What thought was so urgent that he had to scrape it straight off the surface of his synapses rather than let it move through the usual sequence of conceptual and syntactic formation? What exactly is the usual sequence that Husserl was trying to disrupt or cut through? It may be relevant that Husserl was a mathematician before he was a phenomenologist. Mathematics has, in common with shorthand, an intention to reduce or abstract a relatively larger piece of meaning to a relatively smaller set of marks. But mathematics is not done in haste. We think of a mathematical equation as something that happens at the end of a long process of question and pondering, not first and fast. Shorthand, on the other hand, is a tachygraphic system enabling a person to write legibly at the rate of speech. What is the rate of speech? It is tied to the rate at which thought moves in the mind. But we all know from the sensation of it that thought moves more quickly and in a different way than speech. Speech is already a kind of shorthand. Yet speech again is quicker and different than sentences written down. There seem to be veils upon veils upon veils here. Where is the original surface? If we were romantics, and possibly some of us are romantics, we might imagine that there is in our minds one or two beats before a thought forms itself into anything like mental speech, into phrase or sentence, into an order of communication, something earlier, rougher, more gripped, more frail, more saturated, something that will dry away like the dew or crumble like prehistoric paint as soon as it's exposed to air. Something that, compared to a sentence, is still wild. Husserl wanted to press the lips of this thing onto paper and make a mark. What did he plan to do with the marks afterwards? Whatever his plan was, 30,000 pages of manuscript attest he couldn't carry it out. Or maybe he had no plan. Maybe he just wanted to cut the thing free from use and let it disappear into its own presence. There was an artist named Gordon Matta Clark, born New York City 1943, who completed more than 50 artworks before he died untimely, age 35, in 1978. Not one of Gordon Matta Clark's artworks is extant. To know what they were like, you have to consult archival photographs or ask people who saw them. What Gordon Matta Clark liked to do was cut things, usually big things. He split a house in half in New Jersey in 1974. He cut huge circular and boat-shaped holes in the walls, floors, and ceilings of a Paris office block in 1977. He made a diagonal pattern of spherical cuts up through the floors, ceilings, and roof of a Chicago apartment complex in 1978. These structures were all slated for demolition before he found them, and he got permission to intervene in and alter the process of ruin, which ran its course after he had finished. His best-known work is one for which he did not get permission. In 1975, prowling around the New York City waterfront, he found an abandoned pier that appealed to him. He broke into Pier 52 and spent 2 months making cuts 20 to 30 feet long and 10 to 18 inches thick in the corrugated steel of the wharf building, pie-shaped, sickle-shaped, and elliptical cuts. He also cut through the floor to expose the water below. He said various things about these cuts. He liked the way light passed alive across the floor. He wondered how it would be to sit and watch this passage of light over the span of, say, a year. He wanted to make volume visible. He wanted to see the Hudson River sparkle inside. He spoke of liberating the compressed force of a building simply by making a hole. He hoped to retranslate the space into something he could taste. Soon enough, the police found out about the retranslation going on at Pier 52. The site was confiscated, the building padlocked shut, charges brought against Gordon Matta Clark, who left the country for a time. The work, which Gordon Matta Clark had titled Day's End, continued to be visited by people who broke in. It was soon demolished by the New York City Economic Development Agency. By the time of Gordon Matta Clark's death 3 years later, critics were calling Pier 52 a radiant, perilous cathedral and an example of a revolutionary new genre of behavioral architecture. So it goes with the prophets. You see them float, and how they float, and how can they? Gordon Matta Clark did not call his project architecture. He invented a word, an architecture. This word has a nice etymology. If you take the prefix an, A-N, as an indefinite article, it implies his work is one of many possible architectures. If you take an as a negative, his work is an antithesis or antidote to whatever architecture claims to be. I just like to get in there and alter it, he said. Each of his alterations was analytical. He did months of research before starting to cut a building. The cuts were based on exact knowledge of what he called the semiotic system of the building's construction. His method was to cut away surface until he could see what was really inside. He made a building into an abstract of itself. Not so much to create beauty as to get information. He said his cuts were probes. He was probing for something he called the thin edge. This is from an interview he gave in 1974. He says, "It was kind of the thin edge of what was being seen that interested me, as much as the views that were created." Let's pause to consider the etymology of the word etymology. It comes from Greek etumos, an adjective meaning real, true, actual, genuine, and logos, the basic noun for word, story, account, analysis. But the adjective etumos, in turn, has an etymology. It's likely derived from the Greek verb enai, which means to be, to exist. So an etymology can be thought to give the true meaning of a word because it has isness in it. The etymologist makes cuts that show being as it floats inside things, and how it floats, and how can it. To return to Cassandra. Her big prophetic scene in Aeschylus' Agamemnon begins with her screaming, "Atatatoi papoida," as I've already mentioned. After screaming this, she calls out the name of Apollo 6 times, then again a 7th time, but the 7th time, by shifting the inflection of the name slightly, she shows its etymology. Apollo's name is cognate with the Greek verb apolesthai, to destroy utterly, to kill, to slay, to demolish, to lay waste. By crying out, "Epolon emos," Cassandra can designate the god as my Apollo and my destroyer at the same time, in the same words. If words are veils, what do they hide? What difference does it make to see a wharf building as a cathedral for 10 seconds or 2 months or a year? To see Apollo, the god of healing and truth, as a murderous pun? I only accidentally learned Greek from a bored high school Latin teacher who decided to teach me to read Sappho on my lunch hour. My entire career as a classicist is a sort of preposterous etymology of the word lunch. When Clytemnestra shouts at Cassandra, "What's wrong? Don't you know Greek?" Cassandra responds with a scream and an etymology and a prophetic vision. She splits open our idea of what it is to know Greek. She removes the walls and floorboards, and suddenly we are in a site slated for demolition, this site which is not just her body, not just the city of Troy, not just the house of Atreus, but our whole way of knowing the truth about such things, our longhand approach to every question and answer, our entire careers as classicists or architects or prophets or whatever we are, the way we float, and how we float, and can we float. Cassandra can. Gordon Matta Clark had a twin brother who was mentally unstable all his life and who died by jumping out the window of Gordon's own studio in 1976. I also had a brother and am perhaps over inclined to view brothers as causal. So, leaving causality aside, I wonder if having a brother who comes and goes from his mind all the time might make a person especially aware of holes and splits and disruptions. There is a thin edge that appears where no edge is scheduled. What a sudden amount of information is released there. What a startling amount of fear and pity. After his brother died, Gordon Matta Clark made a work in his memory at a gallery in Paris. He dug a large hole in the floor of the basement of the gallery and sculpted a staircase of shallow descending steps on one side of the hole. Working by the light of a bulb suspended from the gallery above, he was visible to passers-by at street level through a vent in the gallery floor. When the staircase was complete, the hole was filled in again. No trace now remains except a few Polaroids of Gordon Matta Clark digging. Cassandra's last words in Aeschylus Agamemnon are concerned with pity. Here are three translations of lines 1327 to 1330 of the play, just before she goes off stage to her death. 1. Alas for human fortunes, if a man has good luck, some shadow could overturn it. When his luck goes bad, a wet sponge erases the whole picture. For this I feel the greatest pity. Version 2. But you, O human things, a shadow is enough to, a sponge could wipe you off, you who barely float, and how you float, and can you? You I pity. Exit Cassandra. Third version. Sight demolished and removed. Cassandra Float Can, Birthday Cut. Float arts prove which if doesn't. Swimming the she shelter surface struggle at is gigantic the rip. Greek veils crack another. Dime quicker anything away exposed bounce beats. Is she the beam eyeball of rewriting? Is the rendered English home to disbelief like she has sight silence? Good is art offside, call the prophecy a deep glue. House until screaming removes much etymology. And these husserl his husserl quickly to paper. Romantics thought more. Was country to the later art revolutionary so float? My brother disrupted Apollo metrically. In he broke. Alas, really. Just overturn it, you can. Pity the Polaroids. Cassandra Float Can Final Cut. If gigantic veils bounce silence offside screaming, these romantics float until lunch broke. Alas, just exit. Aeschylus Agamemnon 1180 to 1183. As brightness blows the rising, and hang in it, their glory, stare out. The end. Thank you and good night.